This episode of the Children's Literature Podcast is brought to you by Your Kids' Nap Time. Your Kids' Nap Time. When you should be getting work done, but you just end up messing around on your laptop. Welcome to the Children's Literature Podcast. I'm your host, TQ Townsend. This episode is about Mrs. Frisbee and the Rats of Nim. Today, I'll be discussing a wonderful work of science fiction about a brave single mother and the strange world she must descend into in order to save her children. But first, I had some letters from listeners. I received some very nice feedback about the recent series on the songs in The Hobbit, including one from Sonia, who asked if I did all the singing and music myself. I did. The music on the show is done with a combination of software and real instruments, and I did my best to replicate the sounds of a choir by recording myself in multiple tracks. It would have been nice to have access to many musicians and a full-on recording studio, but I also wanted to encourage listeners to try making amateur music. Children will never feel confident writing and performing their own songs if we give them the message that only professional performances are acceptable. My song versions were, as one choir teacher used to put it, a little rough, but good enough. I also had a question from listener Mick, who asked, "Are there any children's books that you think are overrated?" Yes. I try to keep it positive on the show, and I deliberately steer clear of politics unless it's an important part of a book's history. But there are some books that are quite famous despite having bad writing or even bad messages. I'll do an episode soon on the top 5 children's books that I feel are overrated. Thanks for your idea, Mick. In the early 1970s, the field of psychology was still pretty new. It had finally gained respect as a proper academic field, so there was huge public interest. Pop culture, especially in the area of science fiction, always draws on themes from the current day. Mrs. Frisbee and the Rats of Nim by Robert C. O'Brien was first published in 1971 and was directly inspired by real scientific research performed with animals at the National Institute for Mental Health, NIM, in Bethesda, Maryland, as well as earlier works of science fiction that deal with the sometimes misguided quest for human perfection. O'Brien was influenced by the work of John B. Calhoun, a researcher who studied rats at NIM from the 1940s to the 1960s. O'Brien also had to have been familiar with the story Flowers for Algernon, which came out as a short story in 1959 and was expanded into a novel in 1966. The book featured a mouse called Algernon, who is made very intelligent by an experimental surgery. But in that tale, poor Algernon is ultimately killed by the treatment, whereas in Mrs. Frisbee and the Rats of Nim, the biological modifications made to the rats are far more successful than the researchers could have dreamed. The 1970s was a period in time when there was a lot of interest in psychology, studies of intelligence, and the exciting or menacing ways that scientists could alter the brain. Belief in telepathy and extrasensory perception was common. Films, novels, and comic books featured characters with amazing mental powers. The X-Men used their abilities for good and evil in countless comic books. Carrie wreaked gruesome revenge on high school bullies in the novel and horror movie named for her. And most famously, Star Wars featured characters who could move objects using only mental powers. While Mrs. Frisbee and the Rats of Nim is very much a science fiction book influenced by popular topics of its own time, it also owes a lot to a very old work of sci-fi. In fact, many scholars call it the first proper science fiction novel. Frankenstein by Mary Shelley was published in 1818. This was decades before the rise of modern medicine and more than a century before there were any kind of standards for ethical research. And yet, these very issues are at the heart of the story. Victor Frankenstein engages in secret experiments to create life from dead matter. This project is unethical from beginning to end and, within his cultural context, probably blasphemous too, as it usurps the power to create life from God himself. Victor creates a creature of great intelligence, but then rejects it, leaving it alone and subject to the cruelty of the world. The creation becomes a murderous monster, destroying the members of Victor's family one by one, and ultimately killing himself and his creator. The rats of Nim are a cuter, cuddlier version of Frankenstein's monster, who get a much happier ending. They were humanely captured for lab research and treated well by scientists working in a properly run facility. Like Frankenstein's monster, they were also given the gifts of both life and intelligence. They weren't created from dead matter, as was the creature in Frankenstein, but as rats living off scraps at a farmer's market, they lacked both the intelligence and lifespan to live lives of any significance at all. The DNA modifications they receive make them as clever as humans, perhaps even more clever than clever humans, and it's also possible that they have become immortal. Instead of being rejected by their creators, the rats are actually quite prized by them. One of the rats' early revelations is that they can get away with quite a lot of mischievous behavior in the lab because they're too valuable for the scientists to dream of harming or destroying them. Eventually, it's the rats who reject their creators, using their wits and a few items pilfered from the office to escape. But they would have been unable to succeed without the help of some mice, who have been given the same experimental treatments and join in the jailbreak. The rats and mice travel for some time, eventually setting up a colony at a farm owned by the Fitzgibbon family. This name is a good joke on the author's part, as Fitz means son of, and a gibbon is a kind of ape, and one of the less intelligent ones at that. Son of an ape is an appropriate name for the humans in this tale, as the rats outwit the humans in every encounter. They leave them behind, both in terms of their biological evolution and their decision to set up a rat civilization separate from all humanity. One of the mice, Jonathan Frisbee, marries a wild field mouse and has four children. He is later killed by the farmer's cat, and it is at this point that the book begins. Jonathan's widow lives with the children in a partially sunken cinder block in the farmer's garden. It's an ideal winter home, but will have to be abandoned in the spring when the farmer plows up the plot. But Mrs. Frisbee has a problem. Her youngest son, Timothy, is gravely ill. One of the mice of Nim, Mr. Ages, diagnoses him with pneumonia and provides a medicine that seems to be some kind of homemade antibiotic. But the child must be kept indoors for some time until he's well again, long past moving day. Mrs. Frisbee seeks out the help of the rats, unaware of her late husband's history, but courageous enough to do anything to save her children. What I admire most about Mrs. Frisbee is her courage. There's nothing special about her. She's just an ordinary field mouse who is pulled into an extraordinary world of rats building an underground kingdom complete with electricity, machinery, air conditioning, and an alarm system. But because she is ordinary, her courage is all the more impressive. She has to do many terrifying things for the sake of her kid's safety. She has to climb onto the back of a crow and cling desperately to his feathers as he flies her through the air. She has to travel over rough terrain with the threat of predators all around her. She has to enter the home of an owl to beg him for advice, while knowing that he very well might eat her. She has to sneak into the farmhouse and put sleeping powder in the cat's bowl so that it will not attack the rats while they use their machinery to transplant the Frisbee's home to a safe location. Mrs. Frisbee is very afraid in all of these situations, and rightly so. But she does everything that's necessary despite that fear because of her love for her children. She is very much a tribute to every single mother who has worn old clothes because her children needed new shoes, or gone without a meal so she could pay for the medicine for her sick kids. She never asks for compliments or credit, but she will ask for any help she can get. And as fascinating as she finds the backstory of the Rats of Nim and their plan to travel deep into the forest to form an independent rat civilization, she never lets that curiosity distract her from her goal. Another thing I admire about Mrs. Frisbee is that she's willing to go on an exciting, dangerous adventure, but she doesn't see these adventures as what defines her. Poorly written tales can make it seem as though having strange and dangerous adventures are what makes life good. In fact, getting through the adventure should be the goal of a truly heroic protagonist. Mrs. Frisbee is like a soldier sent to war. If she liked fighting the war, she'd be a bit of a psychopath. She's willing to fight, but only for as long as it takes to secure the health of her family and the safety of her home. After that, she just wants to get back to the life that she chose for herself. Mrs. Frisbee is very clear-eyed about the risks involved in the rat's plan to drug the cat and move the house, and she takes responsibility for the role she must play. When there is nobody else to slip into the farmhouse and drug the cat food, she volunteers for duty. At first, the rats try to discourage her, as she's never done anything like this before, lacks the biological enhancements her husband had, and has her children to think of. But she's firm, saying, quote, "You forget. I'm Timothy's mother. And if you and Arthur and others in your group can take risks to save him, surely I can too." End quote. She isn't saying this to brag. She doesn't overestimate her skills. This is just the kind of quiet, ordinary courage of a decent person. The reason Mrs. Frisbee is able to succeed is because she builds friendships. She does this through acts of kindness and demonstrating the kind of integrity that others cannot help but admire. Friendly cooperation is a major theme in this book, and mutual kindness is what allows most of the characters to survive. The entire plot is kicked off when Mrs. Frisbee helps Jeremy, a young crow who's gotten tangled in a bit of shiny string. She cuts him free before the cat can kill him. Jeremy is the one who brings her to consult with the owl, and the owl directs her to the rats after finding out that she's the widow of Jonathan Frisbee. Mrs. Frisbee never knew about her husband's connection with the rats, nor that he died while trying to help them. It's because she is kind and courageous that others are kind to her and believe in her, and she's able to learn what favors she's owed because her late husband had also been a good team player. The way the characters treat one another is what I would call, as someone from the west of the United States, being neighborly. The Rats of Nim never invite Mrs. Frisbee to join their colony, and it never occurs to her to ask. She has her home and priorities, and they have theirs. But they are neighbors, and being neighborly means lending a hand when it's needed, as a matter of principle. Not all of the animals in the book are allies, but there is one funny running mantra that's repeated. We all help one another against the cat. Both Mrs. Frisbee and the owl say this line, using exactly the same words. This tells me that this is a shared truth for all the animals living near the Fitzgibbon farm. This line also illustrates how there can be existential threats so great that even creatures as different as an owl and a mouse would team up to fight it. However, since everybody seems to hate the cat, the Fitzgibbons call him Dragon and make him stay outside as much as possible, so they don't even seem to like him much. I wonder why the rats bother to use sleeping powder on him. Other than the fact that children's novels generally shouldn't show the good guys committing murder, and that a major portion of the plot couldn't happen without the presence of the cat, I'd say the rats should have poisoned his food long ago. Mrs. Frisbee and the Rats of Nim is an absolute page-turner. Depending on how fast you read, you can get through it in 2.5 or 3 hours. I wouldn't rank it just among the best science fiction novels for children, but among the best science fiction novels for all ages. People of my generation often didn't realize that it was a book, as we grew up watching the Don Bluth film, The Secret of Nim. The movie has some strong points, such as its lush color palette and decent soundtrack, But I've always been annoyed by the film's use of a magic amulet to move the Frisbee home instead of the intelligence of the rats and the courage of Mrs. Frisbee. This is a sci-fi story. As soon as a magic amulet solves the problem instead of the ideas of intelligent creatures, it's fantasy, not sci-fi. The plot changes made to O'Brien's story in The Secret of Nim end up devaluing the courage, creativity, and intelligence of the characters. It's less compelling when a character can just use magic to fix everything in a snap. No hard work is required. No difficult decisions must be made. Just use the pretty magic necklace and everything will be fine. The movie can still be enjoyable, but I would say it follows the usual pattern of film adaptations being inferior copies of the books they're based on. There are a lot of classroom activities that could be inspired by Mrs. Frisbee and the Rats of Nim. As Jonathan Frisbee used to say, the size of the brain is no measure of its capacity. Likewise, the length of a book is no measure of how densely it is packed with wonderful ideas. Students could have a lot of fun imagining their own experiments in which an animal species was made super intelligent. This could just be a brief discussion in class, or it could be a full-blown project with a written report, illustrations, and maps of the animal's society. For example, if cats were made as smart as humans, what would change about them? Would they just use their new smarts to get into the cat treats? Would they be fine with remaining in human houses? Or would they make their own society? What would a city designed and built by cats look like? Would its buildings be tall but made with vertical climbing surfaces and lots of balconies instead of elevators? Would sushi restaurants be popular? Would cat civilization clash with human civilization? What could cause war between the two species? And how would a battle play out? It would be fun to hear what your kids come up with. I would love to see a description of the new civilization of Thorn Valley set up by the Rats of Nim, or the description of a city designed by some other animal species. Send their ideas to letters@childrensliteraturepodcast.com, and I'll read them on an upcoming episode. Mrs. Frisbee and the Rats of Nim can seem like a story that's unlikely to be of interest to anybody. It's about a bunch of vermin, after all. But somehow, it hits the sweet spot of a Venn diagram with circles labeled thought-provoking science fiction and compelling story about an awesome mom. This makes it the sort of book that's impossible to put down, whether you read it just for the action and adventure or for the thoughtful consideration of what it would mean if animals could become as intelligent as humans. You're going to have a great time reading this book, and so will the kids you share it with. You've been listening to the Children's Literature Podcast. Please subscribe and give the show a rating. Send comments to letters@childrensliteraturepodcast.com. I'm your host, TQ Townsend. Thanks for listening.